Accession number 4486, Reel 3.
Colonel King Clark, Reel 3. Were there any special training exercises in Egypt you went out on?
Yes, remembering, of course, that I was only in Egypt for some 8 months altogether. I went on one major exercise, and this was, in fact, within the first few days of my arrival there. It was a divisional exercise, I think the annual divisional exercise, south of Cairo. And we went, I remember, by train from Ismailia up to Cairo and then down to some station south of Cairo where we detrained and marched, I suppose, 20 miles maybe due south into the desert. And it was mainly a question of movement, and there was no minor tactics at all during the exercise, as far as I can recall. I'm sure I would have remembered. And we all got very sunburnt and turned around and marched back again. And it was really something of an endurance exercise, but not one of any tactical military interest as far as the smaller formations are concerned. That's really all I can remember. In fact, that's the only major exercise I took part in at all. And then, of course, because I got there in the spring, and then the summer came in when it came along, and it was very hot, and I think that most of the training was probably done in the winter after the time I'd gone home on a course, and the battalion moved up to Palestine in I think, December or January 1938, that I was sent home on a course. I was sent home on a PT course from Egypt, and in fact I flew home in my aeroplane and went on the PT course, and I had my tonsils out the second time and flew back again and arrived in Palestine, or rather arrived in Egypt and went up by, I forget how, went up to Palestine anyway to join the battalion which had just arrived there. But if I might just talk for a minute about the aeroplane, I had the aeroplane in Egypt all the time I was there, and of course it was great fun. And I did do quite a bit of exploring myself in this machine. And in those days, apart from the cantonment at Ismailia, there were along the canal, there were very few other inhabited areas along the canal, except Port Said, Ismailia, and Suez. Later on, of course, there were bases all the way down the canal and aerodromes all the way down the canal. But we used to go on Sundays sometimes. The Canal de Suez had a lovely bungalow on the shores of the Bitter Lake, the Great Bitter Lake. And the French party would go down by a road there, and I would fly down in the aeroplane with a couple of people maybe and land land on the sand of the desert beside this bungalow, and we'd all swim, and I'd take them up for trips in the aeroplane in the afternoon, and then fly back in the evening. But then also, this was just fun socially, but also I made one or two trips. I flew over to Aqaba, and I flew down quite a long way down the, I forget the name of the place now, down the west shore of the Gulf of Suez, quite a long way down there, and I flew, of course, up to Cairo quite often, to Almaza, and also down the Nile, quite long distances down the Nile. I was very interested in sort of navigation and the geography of the area. I forget a lot about it now. And I flew up to Palestine once or twice, up to Haifa and to Lydda. But this was before the troubles had started. In 1936, it was quite... There'd been troubles in 1936, I think I'm right in saying. 1937 was quite quiet, and they flared up again in 1938 in Palestine.
So it was the renewal of the troubles in Palestine which occasioned the move of your battalion.
Yes. We would otherwise have stayed in Ismailia, I've no doubt, until the end of our tour, which was due, I think, at the end of 38, and then we were due to be posted elsewhere to the Far East.
How did you view the prospects of moving to Palestine when you heard that you had to go?
Well, I was at the PT school at the time, and I was told I got to report back not to Haifa, not to Ismailia, and I was mainly disappointed because I thoroughly enjoyed being in Egypt. And the thought of going off to Palestine, which I knew wouldn't be so much fun, didn't really please me very much. Looking back, though I accepted it because this was just some part of being a soldier. Because I gathered it was a pretty dreary job, the troubles there, which in fact it turned out to be initially. Not dreary, but it was a boring sort of job. Not, again, it was more police work than what I thought was soldiering.
I would have thought it would have been quite exciting, really.
Well, it turned out at the end to be, of course, very exciting. To begin with, it was. To begin with, the excitement of going where you're actually going to be shot at for the first time. But anyway, I flew back to Egypt after the PT course and got to Ismailia. I got to Cairo and I left the airplane at Al Maza Airport, and I flew up in a Misr airline, which was the Egyptian airline run by Airwork Limited, from Al Maza to Haifa. That airline, they were very small airplanes. About six people, I think. And then I joined the battalion there, who were at a camp called New Trafford Camp, not a very named after Old Trafford, just north of Acre. Acre was a marvellous town, as you probably know, a completely walled city, a crusader city, which you looked at across the bay from Haifa. And we were very near Acre, and I used to like to go into Acre. ACRE, that isn't it? It was a great Crusader Center. From there, I'm sorry, we weren't New Trafford Camp to begin with. The battalion was, headquarters was at Tiberias on the Sea of Galilee. And I remember I arrived in Haifa and I was told to make my way out to Tiberias, and I got a lift in an armored car belonging to the Air Force, because the Air Force ran the armored cars at that time in Palestine. The Rolls-Royce armoured car, and there were three of us in it, a squadron leader and the driver and myself, and we were escorting a convoy of trucks as well. And I was very amused, by the way. The squadron leader would say to the driver, reduce speed to 25 knots. The driver said, aye, aye, sir, and slow down. They fall very formal. And anyway, we got to Tiberias, and I reported to the battalion. I was sent up to join my company, C Company, which I'd been in ever since I joined Ismailia. 13 platoon of C Company I commanded, up to Safad, which is right up in the hills in the north of Palestine. And I think it is the city which is, it is the town which in the Bible is described as the city that is upon a hill. I forget the exact wording. The town is set upon a hill. It's about 2,000 feet, I think, something like that, above sea level. Now, and immediately, no, not as much as that, about 1,500 feet. Now, immediately above Safed is Mount Canaan, or Canaan, as it was called. And on the top of Mount Canaan was this Jewish hotel, brand new one, made of sort of concrete block, like a modern hotel. And there was nobody in it. It was vacated, there was nobody in it. And I was put up there with half the company, in command of half the company, with another subaltern and two platoons, about 30 men, about 50 men, I suppose, something like that. And we just sat up in this hotel, and occasionally we were motorized at this time. We had quite a large element of transport. Because by this time, and I'm sorry, by this time we had in fact become a machine gun battalion with Vickers machine guns as opposed to simple infantry. And this was a motorized unit. We were a motorized unit. And we were put up on the top of this Mount Canaan, and we had quite a number of vehicles, and we used to mount these machine guns on sandbags in these 1,500 weight trucks and act as escort to the convoys that we had to send down to Tiberias to pick up rations and send people down and so on. And this is really all we did. And we mounted a guard on the main road, where the track up to the hotel joined the main road. We had a guard there during the day. And at night, we just had an ordinary guard in the hotel. But we were sniped at quite a bit at night from the surrounding, not from the hills, but the fields around the hotel, sometimes quite heavily. And we were ordered not to fire back, though we used to. And we used to, because it was a flat roof, and I used to put a machine gun on the flat roof and fire back. And my company commander used to get rather angry about this, because, you know, he said, you're always just wasting your ammunition firing back at night. You're probably quite right, but it encouraged the soldiers and gave something to do and just sit there being shot at, because the hotel was very, very jerry-built in construction. And I remember one night, I don't know what they were using. We found the cartridge cases afterwards, about a couple of hundred yards or less than that, behind the stone walls which contained the fields around this hotel. And we found the cartridge case, and it was obviously a 450 cartridge, a very heavy rifle. And this went right through the walls and through the inner walls of the passage as well, as these bullets, the bullets from this rifle. But normally they use just ordinary 303 or that sort of thing, Mauser size 300, 303 rifles, and sniped away and made holes in the buildings, and that was about all. They had no artillery or anything. We used to fire rifle grenades back at them, were the best, most effective thing from the roof, just fire the rifle grenades back in their area. But it was really, in a way, quite enjoyable when we got sniped. It was always at night, because it gave something to do. Otherwise, we had nothing to do at all, actually, except just man this position. But what we never did, and I've often thought about this since, what we should have done when this happened, we should have sent out patrols, you know, to try and do something about the people behind the walls, 100 yards away. But we didn't. We just sold to sit tight and do nothing, not even far back.
So you were under orders not to do that type of thing?
We were I was under orders from my company commander not to retaliate by putting a machine gun on top of the roof and firing hundreds of rounds of ammunition back towards where the enemy were firing, the Arabs were firing from.
But had you had orders not to send patrols out after the people?
No, we hadn't, actually. And later on, I did start to do this, yes. Go out with three or four men. I had two or three people who were rather good at this, and we used to go out and sort of creep round and that, but we never got alongside them. We used to go out and take rifle grenades with us, you know, one rifle in each platoon or each section. I think had a cup discharger which you fitted onto the, screwed onto the top of it. This is the old SMLE number one rifle. And we put a 36 grenade in and a ballistite cartridge and fired it, and it just shot the grenade out for about 100 yards range, something like that. This is very effective in these sort of conditions. First time I'd ever used it. I mean, I'd used it in practice back at home, but at the small arms school when I'd gone there on a course and that sort of thing, but I'd never used it in, it was the first time I'd ever used it in anger. Just the same, it was the first time I'd ever been fired at in anger when we were sniped at in the Canaan Hotel. Well, the first time in anger I'd ever fired back at anyone. But the general picture at the time, again, we were not really particularly interested in the general, in the overall picture of why this was happening. But I seem to remember that it was partly due to the fact that they thought the British government were favouring the Jews too much and giving them too much, and the Jews were buying land from them for small amounts of money, because they'd never had any money before anyway, and, you know, to get anything was really something. And then afterwards they had no money, they had no land, they spent their money in the nightlife of Nazareth or something. They had no money left, and they were easy meat for agitators from who were trying to say, you know, out with the Jews, we don't want the Jews here, this is our land, this sort of attitude. But they were governed, it was the Mufti of Jerusalem, who was in Syria at the time, I think, who was the sort of leading light behind this, who was the main, the leader of the these Arab guerrillas who were operating against us. And they had a very sort of convenient sort of almost sort of the same as in the classic guerrilla situation of having a neutral country nearby into which to withdraw when things got too hot or when they'd done whatever they wanted to do. They'd infiltrate in from Syria and go to villages and maybe terrorize villages to the extent that they would persuade them to feed them and so on, whereas the villagers probably want to get on with their looking after their small farms and feeding themselves, keeping themselves alive, really. And then they'd probably shoot, might snipe away at us or create a roadblock and ambush a vehicle or something, and then they'd, or lay a mine, a road or a track. One of our officers, Robin Griffiths, was killed by this means, and then they go back up over the frontier again, out of the way.
What was your attitude towards the people against whom you were fighting?
Not particularly, no particularly strong antipathy. I would think general attitude of the... Again, we had this... In this era, and it was at the end of the, it was the end really of the empire era, and it probably wasn't as strongly felt as it had been, say, before the First War. But we felt that we were there as sort of police, and that we, it was Palestine was part of the empire as far as we were concerned, and you know, we were just keeping the peace, and we didn't feel any particular, I'm quite sure, antipathy towards the Arabs. In fact, in some ways, I think one really rather liked the Arabs. I know the Palestine police preferred the Arab to deal with the Arabs than they did to deal with the Jews. They found them much, though presumably both Semitic races. They found the Arab a man of a better sense of humour. He took his time. He's more tolerant about things, whereas they found the Jews, I think, very much sharper. With their own sense of humour, maybe, but not as much more dedicated to Zion and getting Israel from itself, getting Israel established, well established in Israel. I think, generally speaking, probably one did likely tolerate the Arabs more than the Jews initially, when I first went there.
What was your estimate of the effectiveness of soldierly qualities of the people against whom you were fighting?
Well, I think that they're not very effective. They didn't have very effective armament, you see. Everything's been changed nowadays because the introduction of the what you might call the submachine gun, also this is really revolutionised. The automatic weapon has revolutionised guerrilla warfare. All they had and all we had was a single shot. Virtually all we had was, as far as movement across country. I'm not talking about the Vickers machine gun defence position, because you couldn't move it around just like you couldn't move it across country very easily if there were no tracks or roads. But the ordinary patrol weapon was the rifle, you see, and the officer had his pistol. But you had no. Then you had a Lewis gun, but this was not too effective as a sort of movement weapon if you were for a confrontation. And so, really, the weapons they had really limited the amount of damage they could do. I think we felt angry when they mined roads and blew up vehicles. This we thought was not really quite fair play. But if you met them out at night and they fired you with their rifles and you fired back, well, this was you didn't feel any particular antipathy towards them at all, I don't think. Because only when they did something like mining a road. But they were quite effective. And they were very good shots, some of them. I think they mostly used Mauser rifles and, you know, relics of the Turkish occupation of Palestine. Quite a lot of people I talked to who'd been there many years, particularly a Jewish doctor friend I had who lived in the down near Lake Huli. Well, it's not a lake now, it's been rain, and he was a mosquito malaria expert, because malaria was very prevalent, very, very prevalent around Lake Huli. And he'd been there with the Turks, and he'd said the Turks were very much better at controlling the country than we had been. They were much stricter. The Arab, well, was the old saying, I forget exactly what it is, but I put it in my book, which I wrote some time ago, but the Turk understood the lash and expected the lash, not the Turk, the Arab understood the lash and expected the lash, and the harder you treat them, the better they will behave and the more they will respect you. And there's no doubt that the British have never, I think, really been harsh with the people. They've and I think probably some of the troubles arisen around the world have been due to this. Certainly in Iraq after the war in 1921, when we had the rebellion there, this was very largely due to, undoubtedly, to the fact that the British were not strict enough, whereas the Turks had been very strict before they left and kept everybody down.
What about the qualities of the people against whom you are fighting in terms of being guerrillas, their stamina and mobility and this type of thing? What would be your estimate of their level in that respect?
Well, they operated mainly, of course, almost entirely at night. Yes, they were very mobile across country, and they obviously knew the country well, and I think that in many cases they co-opted local villagers, or they had people who had to go along with them in the local villages who would show them the countryside and take them around, because I think some of them came from Syria and didn't know that part of the country at all in any detail, and obviously they would have had to have had guides. But for me, Palestine really started when I met and started to work for Wingate.
Was this immediately after your period at the Canaan
Hotel? Yes, I think it was in the first time I met Wingate. It was rather amusing, actually, because I was up in my room in the Canaan Hotel doing something or other, and somebody came in and said, "Oh, there's a chap down in the guard room." The guard room being a sort of reception area, if you can imagine. It's a hotel, you come in, you know, reception on the right, there was a hall, and the stairs went up, and I lived up on the first floor. And so I went down, and there was this extraordinary, as I walked down the stairs, I saw in the foyer of the hotel this extraordinary character in an old straw hat and a sort of Palm Beach suit, very scruffy one, standing there. And the person who'd come to tell me this man wanted to see me, he said he's a British officer, but he doesn't look like one. He said, so down I went, and there was this chap, and he said, "Are you the?" I remember very in a very authoritative tone, "Are you the officer in charge here?" And I said, in a rather guarded way, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I'm Captain Wingate of the of GHQ or Royal Artillery," he said. And he said, "I've been apprehended by your men, and I demand to be released immediately." And there, standing beside him, were two rather sheepish-looking soldiers of mine, who'd stopped him at the where the drive up to the hotel met the main road, about 400 or 500 yards away, because this civilian car, he had an open Studebaker, I remember, which I got to know quite well later on, and they'd stopped this car. And here was this man in the back, because he was an extremely untidy man. In the back of the car were a couple of rifles and a few grenades lying on the floor, a lot of maps and things lying around. And naturally, the corporal or whatever it is said, "You come along with us." And he tried to bluff his way through them, but the corporal said, "No, you've got to come up to the hotel and see the officer." And anyway, here he was. But funnily enough, it was the first time I met Wingate, and I thought to myself, this showed a lack of sensitivity. I think he should have realised the soldier was doing his job and that I was doing his job, and he certainly didn't look like a captain in the Royal Artillery. And captains in the Royal Artillery in Paris at that time didn't drive around in old Studebakers full of rifles and things. And he had a very, quite a sort of Semitic look about him, he had a very strong nose, and so it was quite, that was the first time I met Wingate. And that was, then a month went by, and I think it was in May, that I was told I was to report to Wingate, to Captain Wingate, Royal Artillery, or GHQ, he was in the I branch, GHQ, report to Captain Wingate down, I forget where, in Tiberias, I think, because I was to command a special squad from the battalion, especially a selected squad of men from the battalion, to work for him. That's all I knew about it. So I went down, and I had about 12 people altogether. There was Corporal Howbrook, who was my sort of second in command, and about 12 selected thugs from the, well, it's sort of not a strong word, but people chosen who they thought would be suitable for this sort of work. And they hadn't all chosen all the right sort of people either at that time. And my batman, Amelan, and so I reported. And we were sent to, and he told me that what we were going to do was we were going to teach the Jewish supernumerary police in the kibbutz, various kibbutz, how to defend the kibbutz against the Arab terrorists. And at the same time, we were going to do our best to apprehend the terrorists, particularly in their activities against the oil pipeline, which ran from over the hills to Haifa. In the north, this was in the north of Palestine, because the brigade in which I was the second Manchester, was part of the brigade, 16th Brigade, I think it was, which occupied the northern half of Palestine as opposed to the southern half, which was another brigade. They got just two brigades in Palestine at the time. And so I was sent off to, with my gang, to Ayelet HaShaha, which is up just south of Lake Huli, a small kibbutz. And I was there, I forget how long, but it's in my diary, and I was there for some while. And we started off by... Wingate, for the first time, introduced, I think, into my life anyway, the idea that I could use my interest in sort of field craft and you know, really operating as a small unit against the enemy and using your sense, not just marching along with men strung out behind you. And he laid down his sort of training ideas and his... Anyway, it was in Ayelet HaShaha where I was first introduced to Wingate's ideas on anti-terrorist warfare and the methods he was going to use to achieve this, both with these British squads which were recruited and also with the Jewish squad which replaced them.